In the heart of Silicon Valley, where dreams are spun into billion-dollar realities, few stories have captivated public imagination quite like the rise and fall of Theranos. The tale of Elizabeth Holmes, a Stanford dropout who promised to revolutionize healthcare with just a drop of blood, became required reading for entrepreneurs, investors, and business students alike. Bad Blood by John Carreyrou, which has sold over 1 million copies and been translated into more than 20 languages, offers a masterclass in investigative journalism. The book was named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, and was the basis for the HBO documentary, The Inventor, directed by Alex Gibney. What makes this story particularly compelling is how it challenges our assumptions about innovation, disruption, and the cult of personality that drives Silicon Valley. It's not just a business scandal, it's a human drama about ambition, deception, and the dangerous consequences of believing your own hype. Elizabeth Holmes was seemingly destined for greatness from childhood. At 9 years old, when asked what she wanted to be when she grew up, she confidently replied, "A billionaire," rather than the typical childhood dreams of becoming an astronaut or doctor. This early ambition was nurtured by her family's distinguished heritage, descendants of the Fleischmann Yeast Company founders and accomplished medical professionals. Growing up in a household that valued achievement, Elizabeth was regaled with stories of ancestors who had made significant contributions to society. After excelling at St. John's Private School in Houston, Elizabeth entered Stanford University as a president's scholar in 2002 to study chemical engineering. There, she quickly caught the attention of Professor Channing Robertson with her unusual intensity and determination. While most students were enjoying typical college experiences, Elizabeth was already fixated on changing the world through medical technology. The SARS outbreak of 2003 provided a pivotal moment in Elizabeth's journey. Following a summer internship at the Genome Institute of Singapore, she returned to Stanford with a revolutionary idea: a wearable patch that could simultaneously diagnose and treat medical conditions. This concept became the foundation for her patent application and the catalyst for her decision to drop out of Stanford during her sophomore year. With unwavering confidence, Elizabeth launched Real-Time Cures, later renamed Theranos, leveraging family connections to secure initial funding. Tim Draper, a venture capitalist whose daughter had been childhood friends with Elizabeth, provided early capital, followed by corporate turnaround specialist Victor Palmieri. Despite skepticism from medical venture capital firms like MedVenture Associates, Elizabeth's charisma and vision helped her raise nearly $6 million by the end of 2004. As development progressed, the original patch concept proved technically unfeasible, evolving first into a glucose monitor-like device and finally into a cartridge and reader system using microfluidics. By late 2005, Theranos had grown to 24 employees working on a prototype called Theranos 1.0, targeting pharmaceutical companies that spent billions on clinical trials. Elizabeth's confidence was infectious, and she proudly told her team they were being called the hottest startup in the valley. What's remarkable about Elizabeth's early journey was her ability to pivot while maintaining the appearance of unwavering certainty. When technical realities forced abandonment of her original vision, she simply adjusted her narrative without acknowledging the fundamental changes. This pattern, maintaining an inspiring vision while reality told a different story, would become the defining characteristic of her leadership. When respected Silicon Valley engineer Edmund Ku joined Theranos in early 2006, he was captivated by Elizabeth Holmes's vision of saving lives through revolutionary blood testing technology. However, he quickly discovered that the fundamental physics and engineering challenges of Elizabeth's vision bordered on the impossible. Her insistence on using only a finger prick of blood while performing hundreds of tests created insurmountable technical barriers. The core problem was simple but devastating. There simply wasn't enough blood in a finger prick sample to perform multiple reliable tests. Traditional blood testing requires tubes of blood for good reason. Diluting tiny samples introduces significant error margins. Yet Elizabeth refused to compromise on her vision, insisting the technology must work with minimal blood, despite engineers explaining the physical limitations. "We were being asked to do what many of us thought was impossible," one engineer later confided. "When we raised concerns, we were told we weren't being team players." The company spent millions producing hundreds of single-use cartridges for testing, but encountered persistent problems: fluid leakage, contamination, and wildly inconsistent results. Rather than acknowledging these fundamental limitations, Elizabeth compartmentalized information between teams and pushed for unsustainable work schedules, declaring, "The company is all that matters." Elizabeth's management approach was heavily influenced by her secret boyfriend, Sunny Balwani, an older Indian entrepreneur who had made millions during the dot-com boom, along with mentors Don Lucas and Larry Ellison. She seemed to emulate Ellison's aggressive business tactics at Oracle, prioritizing perception over substance. The technical failures became impossible to ignore during a Pfizer pilot study in Tennessee, where Ed had to frantically repair malfunctioning equipment overnight before testing terminally ill cancer patients. Despite these obvious problems, Elizabeth declared the trip a success in a company-wide email, ignoring the fundamental flaws in the technology. As the atmosphere at Theranos grew increasingly oppressive, with Elizabeth filing lawsuits against former employees and implementing strict surveillance measures, engineer Tony Nugent developed an alternative system called Edison. This modified glue dispensing robot replaced the microfluidic approach that Ed had been working on, leading to Ed's dismissal. The irony wasn't lost on remaining employees. The revolutionary technology was now just a converted glue robot with a fancy name. This pattern of prioritizing the story over substance became Theranos' defining characteristic. When faced with technical limitations, rather than adjusting expectations or timelines, the company simply changed the definition of success or concealed failures. This approach might work temporarily in software development, where fake it till you make it is sometimes viable, but in medical testing, where lives hang in the balance, it was a recipe for disaster. By 2007, Elizabeth Holmes had fully embraced her role as Silicon Valley's next visionary leader, explicitly modeling herself after Apple's legendary co-founder. The iPod of healthcare became her go-to description for Theranos' system as she aggressively recruited Apple employees, including product designer Anna Areola. Under Anna's influence, Elizabeth underwent a striking transformation, adopting Steve Jobs' signature black turtleneck and slacks and cultivating a distinctive personal brand. The Apple transplants quickly discovered the peculiar culture Elizabeth was building at Theranos. Before early meetings, she would sit in her SUV blasting hip-hop to pump herself up. On her desk sat an inspirational paperweight reading, "What would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail?" A question that seemed to guide her increasingly detached from reality leadership style. The company's IT department operated with paranoid levels of surveillance, monitoring employees' communications and social media activity while maintaining strict information silos between departments. When Steve Jobs died in October 2011, Elizabeth's reverence reached new heights. She halted company operations, flew an Apple flag at half-mast, and increasingly referred to Jobs as Steve, as if they had been close friends. According to engineering staff, she began adopting management techniques straight from Walter Isaacson's biography of Jobs, including his infamous staring technique during meetings and his habit of firing employees during elevator rides. Elizabeth's Jobs-inspired leadership style included theatrical flourishes that became increasingly disconnected from the company's technical reality. At a Christmas party in December 2011, she declared with deadly seriousness, "The mini lab is the most important thing humanity has ever built. If you don't believe this is the case, you should leave now." 6 weeks later, at a celebration of the Safeway Alliance, she proclaimed that Theranos would become Silicon Valley's dominant company, boasting, "I'm not afraid of anything, except needles." The irony of this needle phobia became a central part of her origin story, though former classmates later questioned its authenticity. Whether genuine or manufactured, this personal narrative of overcoming fear of blood draws became a powerful marketing tool as Elizabeth presented herself as the empathetic founder solving a universal problem. What's particularly fascinating about Elizabeth's emulation of Jobs is how selectively she borrowed from his playbook. While she adopted his aesthetic, management style, and reality distortion field, she missed the fundamental substance that made Jobs successful: his obsessive attention to product quality and functionality. Jobs might have been difficult and demanding, but Apple products actually worked. Theranos devices did not, a critical distinction that would ultimately prove fatal to her vision. In January 2010, Theranos approached Walgreens with an irresistible pitch. They had developed small devices capable of running any blood test from a few finger prick drops in real time at less than half the cost of traditional labs. For Dr. Jay Rosen, a 65-year-old physician on Walgreens' innovation team, this represented the holy grail of diagnostic medicine, making blood tests less painful, more accessible, and potentially life-saving through early detection. What Walgreens didn't know was that Theranos' technology simply didn't work as claimed. When Kevin Hunter, a lab consultant with deep diagnostics experience, visited Theranos headquarters in August 2010, he noticed troubling signs: excessive security measures, refusal to show their laboratory, and inability to demonstrate a live test despite 2 weeks' notice. While Hunter grew increasingly suspicious, Dr. Rosen remained enchanted by Elizabeth's vision and charisma. "Something doesn't add up here," Hunter warned in a report, suggesting Theranos might be overselling or overstating where they are scientifically. His concerns were largely ignored as Walgreens executives, fearful that CVS might secure a deal with Theranos first, pushed forward with the partnership. Meanwhile, Theranos simultaneously pursued Safeway as another retail partner. CEO Steve Bird, who had developed a keen interest in healthcare after recognizing how rising medical costs threatened his company's profitability, was particularly impressed by Elizabeth's presentation. The emotional appeal of reducing needle suffering resonated strongly with Safeway executive Laurie Renda, whose husband was battling cancer and enduring frequent painful blood draws. Safeway ultimately committed $350 million to remodel over half of its 1,700 stores with upscale wellness centers featuring deluxe carpeting, custom cabinetry, granite countertops, and flat-screen TVs. Despite numerous missed deadlines that Elizabeth blamed on events like the Japanese earthquake, Bird remained steadfastly loyal to the young Stanford dropout, giving her unprecedented direct access and latitude. The true extent of Theranos' deception became clear during a beta test at Safeway's employee health clinic in early 2012. Chief Medical Officer Kent Bradley, a former Army doctor, noticed alarming signs. Theranos wasn't using its own devices on site, but instead couriering blood samples to Palo Alto. Phlebotomists were drawing both finger stick and traditional venous blood, results took up to 2 weeks, and many tests were outsourced to other laboratories. Most concerning, healthy employees began receiving abnormal test results that proved normal when retested elsewhere. Bradley's detailed analysis showing large discrepancies between Theranos values and other labs was dismissed by Bird, who insisted the technology was sound. By late 2012, Safeway executives were furious. They'd spent $100 million building wellness centers that sat idle, missing financial targets that had factored in projected revenues of $250 million annually. The Walgreens and Safeway partnerships reveal how Theranos exploited executives' fear of missing the next big innovation. By positioning themselves as revolutionary disruptors and leveraging Elizabeth's charismatic persona, Theranos secured major partnerships without providing basic proof their technology actually worked, a testament to the power of storytelling over substance in corporate America. Tyler Schultz, grandson of former Secretary of State and Theranos board member George Schultz, joined the company after graduating from Stanford, inspired by Elizabeth's emotional speech about preventing premature deaths through early detection. His initial enthusiasm quickly gave way to concern as he discovered troubling practices in Theranos' laboratories. Working alongside colleague Erica Chung, Tyler found that the Edison devices, far from the revolutionary technology described in media profiles, were crude robotic arms with pipettes that produced wildly inconsistent results. More disturbing was how the company handled these failures. Data runs with poor results were discarded, outliers arbitrarily deleted, and validation reports misrepresented test accuracy. For example, Theranos claimed 95% sensitivity for its syphilis test when actual testing showed only 65 to 80% accuracy. In November 2013, Erica encountered serious quality control failures when testing patient samples. When both her first and second quality control checks failed, a non-licensed employee simply deleted 2 of 12 test values as outliers and processed the patient sample anyway, violating fundamental laboratory protocols that would require taking the devices offline for recalibration. "I realized we were sending out patient results from devices that weren't working properly," Erica later explained. "That's when I knew I couldn't stay silent." Tyler's concerns deepened when he discovered Theranos was violating laboratory regulations by running proficiency testing samples on commercial analyzers while testing actual patient samples on Edison's, effectively cheating on regulatory requirements. After contacting the New York State Department of Health anonymously, Tyler received confirmation that these practices constituted a form of PT cheating that violated state and federal requirements. Armed with this information, Tyler approached his grandfather, George Shultz, hoping the respected statesman would help address these serious problems. Instead, he encountered unwavering loyalty to Elizabeth. When Tyler sent Elizabeth a detailed email outlining his concerns, Sonny Balwani responded with a withering rebuttal that belittled Tyler's knowledge and demanded an apology. Tyler resigned immediately. What followed was a campaign of intimidation that revealed the lengths Theranos would go to silence whistleblowers. Tyler was ambushed at his grandfather's home by Theranos lawyers from Boies, Schiller, and Flexner, who threatened litigation unless he signed documents revealing other sources who had spoken to journalists. Despite intense pressure, including threats to bankrupt his entire family with legal costs, Tyler refused to capitulate. Erica Chung also resigned after refusing to run hepatitis C tests on the unreliable Edison devices. When she later raised concerns with regulators, Theranos had her tracked to her temporary residence and served with threatening legal letters. The whistleblower's experiences highlight a troubling aspect of Silicon Valley culture, the extreme measures companies sometimes take to protect their narratives and valuations. In an industry that celebrates disruption and rule-breaking, the line between innovative thinking and unethical behavior can blur. Tyler and Erica's courage in speaking out, despite personal and professional risks, ultimately helped expose one of the greatest frauds in business history. In June 2014, Fortune magazine published a cover story with the headline, "This CEO is out for blood," catapulting Elizabeth Holmes to instant stardom. The article disclosed Theranos' $9 billion valuation and Elizabeth's majority ownership, while repeating now familiar comparisons to Jobs and Gates. Forbes quickly followed, dubbing her the youngest woman to become a self-made billionaire. A cascade of media coverage and accolades followed, features in major publications, television appearances, prestigious awards, and invitations to elite boards and councils. The timing was perfect. Elizabeth's emergence satisfied the public's hunger to see a female entrepreneur break through in the male-dominated tech world. Her story checked all the boxes of an inspiring narrative. Young visionary drops out of prestigious university to pursue world-changing idea, overcomes skepticism to build billion-dollar company, and maintains humble focus on improving humanity rather than personal enrichment. Behind this carefully crafted image was a sophisticated media strategy. Elizabeth hired TBWA Chaya Day, Apple's famous advertising agency, to create Theranos' brand identity. Creative director Patrick O'Neill identified the tiny nanotainer blood collection tube as the perfect visual representation of the company's innovation. Security was so tight that Christian's Duke friend Dan Edlin personally transported the nanotainers to the agency, never letting them out of his sight. The resulting campaign featured arresting images paired with slogans like "One tiny drop changes everything" and "The lab test reinvented." Elizabeth enhanced her compelling persona by sharing a heartwarming message about catching diseases early so no one would have to say goodbye to loved ones too soon. At conferences, she would pull out a nanotainer during speeches and tell emotional anecdotes about patients' fear of needles. Patrick O'Neill, whom Elizabeth hired as Theranos's chief creative officer, helped craft her image and considered her the company's most powerful marketing tool. For stage demonstrations, Theranos employed elaborate deceptions. Software engineer Michael Craig had created an application that masked test malfunctions on the mini-lab, preventing error messages from appearing. For Vice President Joe Biden's visit to Theranos's Newark facility, Holmes and Balwani created an entirely fake automated laboratory, lining the walls with non-functional mini-labs transported from Palo Alto. Biden was thoroughly impressed, calling what he saw the laboratory of the future. What makes the Theranos story particularly fascinating is how it reveals the power of narrative in the business world. Elizabeth understood that a compelling story, especially one that aligns with cultural desires and values, can override critical thinking and due diligence. Investors, partners, journalists, and even government officials were so enchanted by the narrative of a brilliant young woman revolutionizing healthcare that they failed to ask basic questions about whether the technology actually worked. This phenomenon isn't unique to Theranos. From WeWork to Nikola, we've seen how charismatic founders can leverage powerful storytelling to build billion-dollar valuations on shaky foundations. The difference with Theranos was the potential human cost. Unreliable blood tests that doctors used for medical decisions, potentially endangering patients' lives. On October 15, 2015, The Wall Street Journal published John Carey Rue's explosive front-page story, A Prized Startup Struggles, revealing Theranos' deceptions and sparking immediate controversy. The article exposed that Theranos ran most tests on conventional machines, diluted fingerstick samples, manipulated proficiency testing, and raised serious questions about its device's accuracy. The story ignited a firestorm, becoming the talk of Silicon Valley and dividing the tech community between Holmes's defenders and those whose suspicions were confirmed. Elizabeth appeared on CNBC's Mad Money with Jim Cramer the evening the story published, portraying herself as a visionary being smeared by entrenched interests. This is what happens when you work to change things. First they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world. She gave evasive answers about specific allegations and attempted to spin the nanotainer withdrawal as voluntary, though the FDA had actually forced the company to stop fingerstick testing. Upon returning from a Harvard Medical School board meeting, Holmes gathered Theranos employees in the cafeteria, appearing disheveled with glasses instead of her usual contacts. Standing with Balwani and King, she defiantly claimed the journal articles contained falsehoods planted by disgruntled ex-employees and competitors. The meeting culminated with Balwani leading employees in chanting, "Fuck you, Carey Rue," multiple times, a surreal moment that revealed the cult-like atmosphere at the company. Despite the scandal, Holmes honored her commitment to appear at the journal's WSJD Live conference, arriving with her security detail to face technology editor Jonathan Krim. During the half-hour interview, which was streamed live on the journal's website, Holmes told numerous bald-faced lies, claiming Edison devices mentioned in the stories were old technology, denying use of commercial equipment for fingerstick tests, and insisting their proficiency testing was legal. The charade began unraveling when the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the chief regulator of clinical laboratories, took action following a complaint from Erica Chang. CMS launched a surprise inspection of the Newark facility, where inspectors encountered security personnel with earpieces, fingerprint scanners on lab doors, and diversionary tactics from Balwani and the legal team. The resulting 121-page inspection report was devastating. It proved Holmes had lied at the journal's tech conference. Theranos's proprietary Edison devices were used for only 12 of the 250 tests on its menu, with all others run on commercial analyzers. The Edisons produced wildly erratic results, failing quality control checks nearly a third of the time. Some tests failed an astounding 87% of quality checks, with results differing from conventional machines by up to 146%. The consequences came swiftly. Holmes sacrificed Balwani, firing her boyfriend and portraying it as a voluntary retirement. Theranos voided tens of thousands of blood test results, including all Edison tests from the previous 2 years, effectively admitting none were reliable. Walgreens terminated their partnership, shutting down all wellness centers. CMS banned Holmes and Theranos from the lab business while criminal and SEC investigations loomed. In a desperate bid to salvage her reputation, Holmes unveiled the mini-lab at a scientific conference, but her presentation lacked substantial data and was widely criticized as inadequate. When a Zika test application failed due to basic safety omissions, investors finally revolted, with partner funds suing for fraud and Rupert Murdoch selling his $100 million investment back to Theranos for $1 to claim a tax write-off. 2 years after promising to publish clinical data to disprove Carrera's reporting, Holmes finally published a paper about the mini-lab in January 2018. The paper revealed significant shortcomings. Blood was drawn traditionally with needles rather than finger pricks. Data existed for only a few tests, with some exceeding recommended accuracy limits. Tests were run one at a time rather than simultaneously, and the components couldn't yet fit into a single box, all contradicting Holmes's revolutionary claims. The SEC charged Theranos, Holmes, and Balwani with an elaborate years-long fraud in March 2018, with criminal indictments following. Holmes was ultimately convicted on 4 counts of defrauding investors and sentenced to over 11 years in prison, while Balwani received nearly 13 years for his role in the fraud. Theranos exemplified Silicon Valley's fake-it-until-you-make-it culture, but took secrecy to extreme levels. Employees couldn't list Theranos on LinkedIn profiles, faced cease and desist letters for job descriptions deemed too detailed, had emails monitored, and worked in heavily partitioned spaces with fingerprint scanners and surveillance cameras. While tech companies often hype products before they're ready, Theranos wasn't just a tech company. It was a healthcare company gambling with people's lives through unreliable blood tests. Though some blame Balwani as Holmes' Svengali, employees who saw them interact describe a partnership where Holmes had the final say. Holmes had been misleading pharmaceutical companies years before Balwani joined in 2009. She maintained iron control, telling one employee the board was just a placeholder, and later restructuring voting rights to give herself 99.7% control. The Theranos scandal offers several profound lessons for the business world. First, it reveals the dangers of unchecked founder worship and the cult of personality that pervades Silicon Valley. Elizabeth's carefully crafted image as a visionary genius helped her raise nearly $1 billion without providing basic proof her technology worked. Second, it highlights the critical importance of corporate governance. Theranos's board, stacked with aging statesmen with minimal healthcare or technology expertise, failed in its fundamental duty to provide oversight. When board members like Avi Tavanian raised concerns, they were swiftly removed. Third, it demonstrates how the venture capital model's emphasis on rapid growth and disruption can create perverse incentives. The pressure to achieve unicorn status, a billion-dollar valuation, pushed Elizabeth toward increasingly deceptive practices to maintain the illusion of success. Finally, the Theranos story underscores the essential role of investigative journalism in holding powerful interests accountable. Without Kereru's dogged reporting and the courage of whistleblowers like Tyler Schultz and Erica Chung, the fraud might have continued indefinitely, potentially harming countless patients. Perhaps the most chilling aspect of the Theranos saga is how close Elizabeth Holmes came to getting away with it. Had the technology been slightly more feasible, or had she been slightly more willing to acknowledge limitations, she might have eventually developed a working product that, while falling short of her grandiose claims, could have been commercially viable. Instead, her refusal to accept reality led to one of the most spectacular falls from grace in business history. A cautionary tale about the dangers of believing your own hype in a culture that rewards storytelling over substance.